listening to Bits of Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. This week, I talked to Melissa Plunkett, a midwifery student and mother of two, about informed consent and maternity care. She shares her story of a drawn-out, confusing birthing experience that ended up in an emergency C-section and a vindicating VBAC birth. She also describes looking for help with the consequences of a very traumatising event and being fobbed off and told that her complaints were only cosmetic. To the Bits of Me patrons out there, a big thank you as always for helping me to keep these conversations going. If you'd like to support the podcast as well, go to patreon.com/bitsofme to sign up. Had an emergency C-section back in 2012. Do you want to tell me what happened that led to that?
Yeah. So I was young. I was only, 22, I think, and as green as they come. So, much wanted baby. And I was completely clueless about pregnancy and birth. It's like, you get pregnant, you have a baby. You know,
that's kind of what most people know anyway, isn't it? When you first go into
it. Yeah. You know, there wasn't much education like in school and things like that about it. Like it was more, don't get pregnant.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, my pregnancy was fine. I wasn't really sick. And I wound up at like 41 weeks. And then all of a sudden I had this feeling of, okay, well, apparently I shouldn't be pregnant anymore.
Mm.
And people started having the conversation of like, well, you know, you've been pregnant now for a long time. And I was kind of like, okay, cool. But like, what does that mean? You know, you don't just suddenly stop being pregnant when someone says you've been pregnant for a while. And of course you have the questions of like, oh, you know, you still haven't had the baby. No, I haven't.
Clearly.
Yeah. But I ended up with weekly appointments, you know, in the hospital to check the baby's heart and check the volume of the waters around the baby to make sure, you know, all that was fine. And then there were conversations about induction.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, that's just something that, you know, you do. And they were like, yeah, that's the safest option. That's what we do. And then I kind of started to research more into the induction side of things. And I read that there was, you know, different opinions out there about going to 42 weeks and how far could you kind of push that date out and what was the safest. And I still was very, very green about it. I just trusted, you know, what I was told by the doctors. Like they've, you know, got their degree, they've done this, is what they do. So I was very much led by them. I think I did request a sweep at one of the appointments when I was like 41 weeks. I'd been in, they checked the baby, checked, you know, the waters, and I got a sweep. And I remember the doctor was like, yeah, look, sure, we'll just see.
Okay.
I was like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
You know, like, that doesn't sound very positive. I was like, did I just go through this sweep where I've had somebody's hands inside me at my cervix having a good root around? And they're like, meh. You know, I was just kind of like, okay, I get the feeling that that was, you know, a pointless exercise. But sure, look, nothing happened. I was due to come in, you know, to kind of start the induction process. I think I was like 41 weeks and 5 days or something. And you're just kind of given an appointment and told to, you know, rock up, head to admissions, and they'll tell you where to go.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, ending up on an antenatal ward. And there was just, I remember looking at it and thinking, like, God, this is something out of, you see, you know, Florence Nightingale, all the like just lines of beds. You know, I was like, oh my goodness, like how many people are going through this process? Like, what is happening? I suppose there's a little bit of reassurance because I was like, okay, well, I'm clearly not the only one going through this process. Mm. But also it very much had a feeling of like a conveyor belt almost.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm.
That's what I was thinking anyway at the time. So I dutifully sat at my bedside and, you know, waited for the doctors to come around and tell me what was going to happen, because I hadn't got a notion. And I was handed a leaflet on induction. But like, you're handed a leaflet and then, you know, the doctor comes in maybe 20, 30 minutes later. So you haven't really processed what you've been given.
Yeah, maybe that should have been given to you at your last appointment before actually coming in to be induced.
Yeah, exactly. It was just a bit mad to expect somebody to read a leaflet, understand what they have read and form questions on it in the space of like, you know, 30 minutes. Mm. So I ended up getting the gel, so the prostatin gel.
Mm.
I was like, this is going to get your cervix ready, you know, get you all starting to dilate or thinned out and stuff. I was like, sounds like a plan, sure. And that was fine. Nothing happened. And I mean, nothing. I remember thinking like, what is going on with my body? Like, it just wants to stay pregnant. Like, what is happening? Like a whole day, I think it felt like a whole day anyway, passed, and the doctors come back around and, you know, they have to check again and see how your cervix is and how you reacted to it. And I remember they were like, yeah, no, there's not much change there. I was like, okay, what's the plan now? And they're like, yeah, we'll just give you more gel. And I'm like, okay, you know, all I could think about was, you know, when you do a little bit of research about induction, all you hear about is the rates of cesarean sections.
Yeah.
And I think at that point I was like, okay, my body's not reacting the way it should be, is the feeling that I'm getting. And now I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, am I going to end up with a section? And obviously that's not where your mind goes when you first get pregnant. You don't automatically think I'm having a section. On your first baby, you kind of just think, you know, you get pregnant, you have a baby. Very simple, really. You know, I kind of had all this fear and worry about it. And I remember just being told like, oh no, like lots of people get two doses of the gel, you know, it's fine. So I was like, okay, it's fine. I didn't feel fine, but you know, I was being told it was fine. So, you know, really I should just kind of, it's fine. So, you know, the same process, you have to lie down for the hour and then you get up and you can move about and, you know, there's baby checks and stuff in between. And then it came to the next step of the process where the doctor's going back in to reassess. And I remember he reassessed and he was like, oh, I can break your waters. I was like, but like what, you know, thinking, oh, you know, my cervix must be dilating and I must be, you know, doing all these great things. They were like, so are you happy for me to break your waters? And I'm kind of like, I don't know. Like, bear in mind that, you know, this doctor has his hand inside of my vagina at this stage saying, are you happy for me to break your waters? And logically, you know, reading the induction leaflet, I know that this is one of the steps.
Yeah, of course.
But I kind of didn't expect to be asked while he is still feeling my waters, you know. So yeah, I mean, I was kind of like, I don't know, yeah. And they were kind of like, oh, you know, this would be the next step. So I was like, okay. And with that, my waters were broken. You know, there was no discussion about what that means or the risks around it or anything really at all, what to expect. It was just something that had to be done. So it was done. And I remember there was a bit of, I won't say panic. I felt panicked, but I don't think, you know, the staff were panicked. But when they broke my waters, there was meconium. So grade one meconium, the first kind of like baby had done a poo. And there was a bit of like a hurried kind of reaction to, okay, there's meconium. We need to see if the baby's okay. We need to put you on a monitor. So I was, you know, I was very, very compliant and just scared because of the quickness that things were happening. You know, like it was just, it went from, oh, yeah, we'll break your waters. This is totally fine. This is the next step to, we need to put you on a monitor right now to make sure that your baby's okay. Once the monitor was done and the baby was okay, there was no more conversation about it. You know, there was no more explanation of what that meant and why there was such a hurriedness at that moment, but now it was totally fine. You know?
Yeah. So you being on a monitor then presumably meant that you were stuck lying down in bed, or?
Yeah. So I was stuck at that moment for, you know, the 20 minutes or so. And what they don't tell you is when your waters are broken, it makes your contractions so much worse. Like, yeah. They just intensify. So it's not just like we're going to break your waters and this is very casual and this is our day to day. It was only after the waters were gone and I was like, oh, that contraction was not a period cramp.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh yeah, that's normal. That happens. You know, it's almost like things I would like to know before these decisions are made, you know, even just to be prepared for it. But, you know, after that, the baby was fine and, you know, I did get to move around a little bit. Nobody really said, well, actually, we're asking you to go and mobilize now because this is the effect that this will have. You know, this, we want you to move, to get your baby to come down into the pelvis, to really get, you know, the baby's head applied to your cervix. This will all help the dilation process. It was just kind of like one of those kind suggestions that, like, your mom would say, like, Asher, why don't you go for a bit of a stroll, like, to pass the time, you know, rather than actually, this is quite beneficial for you and these are the reasons why. It was just like, Asher, why don't you take yourself out now, you know? I ended up anyway at the next exam with no progression, you know, not being in labour. My cervix was doing absolutely nothing. You know, obviously you can't just sit around not in labour with your waters broken.
No, exactly.
You now have been put onto this kind of like time scale of things that, you know, there needs to be progression. So I was sent over to the labour ward for oxytocin. So what I was told about that was, oh, you know, we're going to send you over to the labour ward. We're going to get you in labour by giving you this oxytocin drip. And it's going to make your contractions, you know, come more regularly and last longer, and you'll get into labour. I was like, okay, yeah, next step, right? So
yeah,
here I am just walking along this path of induction.
Well, this is it. I suppose, like, it's easy, I suppose, to look back on these things and question a lot of the steps, I think, when we look back with hindsight, knowing that something went in a particular way that we didn't want. And at the same time, when you're there, of course, you're going to be moving to the next stage or next step. You're not going to be moving backward because the baby's going to come out one way or another. So it's not like, you know, you need to move to the next step.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you do. And I think I just felt like I wasn't prepared enough. You know, I didn't know enough. But like, induction is a very necessary process for people. And yeah, you know, if you get to one step and that hasn't completely worked, you do need to go to the next step. Induction is completely necessary in certain situations, like 100%. I just feel, for me personally at that time, I just didn't understand everything. I felt like I was just following the recipe that had been handed to me without fully understanding what we were actually making, if that makes sense. Now, would I change anything if I could go back? No, because I had to follow those steps. I don't think that there was any other process for me to go down. You know, my body reacted how my body reacted. And it was most definitely necessary. I think at that time I was 42 weeks. So I wouldn't change the process that I went down. I think I would change the information that I was given, if that makes sense. I think I would like a better understanding of what was happening and what it meant. I think at that point when I was walking over to the labour ward, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go on this trip and then, you know, things will actually kick off and it'll be fine and I'll end up having, you know, my baby. And I don't think I realised that, you know, you could go over and have the oxytocin drip and still end up having a C-section. And I think that was, it came from, I've done everything I've been told I need to do.
Yeah.
And yet here I am with it not working, with my body not reacting the way it should. So when I went over, I started the drip, and like previously I was planning a natural birth, you know, no epidural, no nothing, which is fantastic when you're, you know, a first time pregnant person, not knowing what's ahead of you.
Yeah.
And I think I'd had the drip for a while and I just thought I can't do that anymore. Mm. You know, the contractions are so intense. And you go from not really having contractions to all of a sudden having these like whopper pains.
Yeah.
So I was like, I will have all of the drugs, please. stick it in my eyeball. I really don't care. Just please give me something. So yeah, I ended up with the epidural. So between the oxytocin and the epidural, both of those, you know, you need to be on a monitor.
Yeah.
So that there's no moving around and kind of breathing through your contractions and being able to stand. You are very much, you know, tied to a bed.
Yeah.
On a monitor. And it just makes the contractions all that much harder to get through. Mm. I mean, once I had the epidural, I didn't really care. I actually had a snooze, you know. It worked so well. I was feeling absolutely nothing. I was like, cool, I'm just going to let everything happen. I'm going to have a bit of a nap, you know. Wake me up when it's time to have a baby. But unfortunately, you know, I'd been a number of hours on the oxytocin and I hadn't progressed as much as, you know, they would have liked. Mm. So at this stage, you know, my waters had been gone for, you know, almost nearly a day at this stage. And my cervix is still not playing game. And there was a lot of words being bandied about, like failed, you know, induction and yeah. failure to progress. And I just kind of thought, like, that's it. Like, my body just, I just can't do it.
Mm.
And again, you know, the doctor was saying, well, the next step here would be a C-section. Like, there's no other option.
Mm.
So obviously, I just want to have a healthy baby. So I ended up having an emergency section. But like, I think it was just the words of, you know, failure to progress, failure to advance, failed induction,
mm.
that I definitely internalized that as my body failed. Yeah. It was given all of the opportunities, you know, I was the 42 weeks, you know, I'd really pushed that out. It was given all of the different drugs and medications that, you know, should work.
Mm.
And then here I was needing this C-section because my body had failed.
Yeah.
And I think that's what stuck with me for a long, long time.
Mm.
And I was sick after the section, so I'd lost I lost a decent amount of blood. Through no fault, you know, it's just something that can happen. Mm. It's a risk with any surgery. And I remember my iron was really low, it took a long time to heal. And I wanted to breastfeed and I was just so unwell. I wasn't making a lot of milk. And at one point, I just had to stop. You know, I was just driving myself into the ground, really. I was pushing and pushing and pushing myself while still trying to heal. I wasn't happy. The baby wasn't happy. Something had to give or I was going to give.
Yeah.
So I stopped breastfeeding. But that then became another thing I had failed at.
Yeah.
Like, even talking about it now, I can feel the tears like welling up. I think that's something that's really difficult to come to terms with when you think about it in that way. People are made to create life and birth babies and breastfeed, and here was my body not able to do those things.
Yeah.
It's definitely a very emotive, you know, topic even now, and that baby is 9.
Yeah.
So,
how did that impact on how you felt when you felt pregnant again then a couple of years later?
For the first number of weeks, it didn't even enter my mind.
Mm.
You know, I was just so consumed with having a toddler and being pregnant and the joy of all of that bringing, you know, that brings to a family. And then as I kind of hit like 36, 37 weeks, I started to get that sense of dread.
Mm.
It was like a niggling little critic, I think, that we all have, saying, well, what if your body can't do it this time?
Because you had requested a VBAC, right?
I had requested a VBAC. And I remember being at a clinic and seeing whichever consultant was on that day. And, you know, he was like, I see you want a VBAC. And me all delighted with myself. Yeah, I do. Like, you know, it's going to be great. And I'm going to take that power back. And and he was like, well, you know, I need to talk to you about the risks. And I had done an awful lot of research. You know, I had sat through different courses and I'd really educated myself this time around, because I had felt so unprepared the first time.
Yeah.
So I was full on ready, you know. Yeah, I was like, I know about, you know, uterine rupture, you know, possibilities. And I know that, you know, all these different things, totally prepared. And my first baby was 4.6 kg, so 10 pounds, 3 ounces.
Yeah.
So he was a decent chunk of a baby. So there was all the talk of, you know, big babies and stuff. And I, yeah, I hear that. And I'll never forget, he said, you know, at some point, you may need to just realise that you need to have a section.
Right.
I was like, why? Like, why would I just have a section? Like, why can't I, you know, try like every other person to have this natural birth? And, you know, I'd read up studies and, you know, if I was to have another section, that's kind of limiting my family choices and it has a lot of impacts on me. And I kind of said, I don't understand, you know, I think a VBAC would be, you know, a much better option. And he said, well, you know, at some point you need to realize that maybe having a C-section is better than having a dead baby.
What?
And I was just shocked. I was just sat there with my toddler in tow, as you are at these clinics. And I was just so taken aback. And I think it was at that point that I realized that I was either going to have to fight for the choices that I wanted to make for my body, or just go back to the person who, you know, agreed with things without really fully understanding the reasons behind them. And at that point, I just thought, no, I've done my research and this is the decision that I have made for my body and my future. And I am going to try, you know, to have a VBAC. And that, I like, maybe I was only 34 weeks pregnant or something like that at that point. And I kind of pushed that to the back of my mind. And I didn't let it, you know, sink in. I thought, okay, well, that's just that one person. And he's not my actual doctor. He's just a doctor that I happened to see that day. And then, as I said, when I hit the 37 kind of weeks of the term, that was when that came niggling back, that little thought in the back of my head of, am I making the right decision? Can my body do this? You know, it failed the last time. What's to say it won't fail this time?
Yeah.
I didn't really have much longer to think about it, because at just over 38 weeks, I went into labor. So I started to have contractions. Yeah. So I waited for, you know, a while before going in. You know, the contractions were regular and they were lasting 30 seconds. And I thought, okay, in we go. We'll figure this out. I didn't actually say this. There was a time during the first labor where I was on the continuous monitoring, but they weren't picking up the heart fantastically. There was, you know, like a loss of contact and they just weren't happy that they were getting an adequate picture. And they had to put a lead, a little FSE lead, a fetal scalp electrode on the baby's head. That wasn't explained to me at the time. The midwife that I had, you know, just said, oh, I'm just going to get my manager to come in and examine you. And then the manager comes in, oh, we're just going to examine you and, you know, see how things go. And then I remember that this exam was just not like any of the other exams. Like, there was just so much more to it. Like, there was a lot more pressure. There was a lot, like, it lasted an awful lot longer. And I was really uncomfortable. I hadn't had the epidural at this point. And I was kind of like, whoa, like, what's happening here? And they're like, oh, I know. Sorry about that. No, sweetheart. Just another second. You know, just hang on there. And I was kind of like, oh, I'm clearly uncomfortable. Like, in my head, because I was so young, I didn't really voice it. When it was all done and over with, I remember the manager very matter-of-factly just saying, oh, we just put a little lead on baby's head because, you know, the trace wasn't picking up very well. And now we can monitor baby. And I kind of thought, like, why didn't you just tell me that? Mm. Like, obviously, I'm going to be fine with you doing this because I want my baby to be well and I want you to be able to see that my baby's well. Mm. And she said, oh, you know, that was a little bit more uncomfortable because, you know, your cervix isn't really dilated. So I really had to get back, you know, far up in there to get to baby's head. I mean, that's really not something you want to hear.
No.
When I, at the time I said, right, okay, that's done. It is what it is. And now I understand why it was so uncomfortable and so painful. And I think after the fact, I was so annoyed and upset, my body failing and that kind of mindset that I was in,
mm.
that I just had this mistrust of the kind of the midwives and the healthcare professionals, not just midwives, but, you know, the doctors, everybody who was there.
Yeah.
You know, nobody trusted me with the information.
Mm.
Nobody explained things. It was almost like how you'd explain things to a child who you don't think has the capacity to fully understand all of the ins and outs.
Mm.
Oh, you know, this is what we're going to do, but sure, it's grand. Sure, this is, you know, we do this all the time.
Yeah.
Mm. That really stuck with me, especially for the second birth.
Mm.
It really added to the whole, you know, I don't want to be monitored and I don't want to have an exam because I can't trust that what you're going to say you're going to do is actually
yeah.
what's going to happen.
Mm.
And I think walking back into that building, I just was filled with this sense of, I'm not even sure how to describe it. Like, it wasn't a dread, but it was just that kind of heaviness
mm.
of what had happened before. And I thought, well, if I don't have CTG machines, if I don't get stuck to a bed and I get to move about, things should just progress naturally. That's giving myself the best chance. And I'd read up about CTGs and the benefits and, you know, the kind of side of perhaps they can lead to more intervention. And I wasn't really sure about it. But at that moment, when I was being assessed, I just point blank refused. I was like, no, no one's touching me. No one's putting a CTG on me. No one's, like, in my mind, it would be tying me down to a bed.
Yeah.
Because that was my experience before. And now I can look back and realize that I was just traumatized from what had gone on and what had happened.
Mm.
You know, that there was an awful lot of hurt and an awful lot of fear around it.
Mm.
But yeah, I was definitely that patient that I'm sure midwives and doctors absolutely hate to see, because at the end of the day, they want, you know, a healthy baby and a healthy woman. And here I was telling them that they couldn't do the job in, you know, the way that they knew how to take care of me. And I remember the midwife I had was absolutely lovely and so understanding. And she was like, look, you know, I need to get my manager in to talk to you about it. And then the manager came and she just took the time to explain things to me.
Mm.
You know, she just gave me the rationale of, this is why we're doing this. This is why we need to do this, or why we would like to do this. And I think I still didn't trust that a 20 minute monitoring, that it was going to end in the 20 minutes.
Mm.
I was just fearful that it was just going to escalate into something else. So once she explained things to me, I agreed. I said, okay,
yeah,
let's do this. No problem. And it was fine. You know, the trace came off and I was able to move. I was free. But the next thing that happened was that I wasn't technically in labor.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, you have got to be kidding me.
Did they want to send you home then? Or
they didn't want to send me home. So because this was my second baby and they were like, you know, your cervix is almost there, but you're just not fully in established labor, they said, we'll send you over to our antenatal ward.
Mm.
And I think at that point, I was just in absolute fear. Because obviously the antenatal ward is where the inductions happen and, you know,
yeah.
that whole process had happened. But there was a lot of reassurance, you know, as I said, the midwife that I had was amazing, you know, and just explained what to expect when I went over, that there wouldn't be a lot of, you know, monitoring unless something happened, you know, unless my waters went and, you know, there was meconium or anything like that. You know, I was just going to go over, I was going to labor a little bit longer, get myself into established labor and come back and have a baby. And she's like, you know, go over and get into the shower. And so that's what I did. I think I went over, I was in the shower for like forever, you know, I was up, I was walking, I was like doing lunges in the, in the hallways. And then it got to a point where, you know, there was definitely changes happening. And obviously I sounded different because I remember this midwife just popping her head in through the curtain where I was standing, like by the bed. And she was like, is everything okay? And she was like, maybe we'll just check your, you know, your cervix and see how you're doing. And at that point I knew, okay, well, this has to happen for me to be able to get back to the labor ward. So I was like, absolutely. check it three times, you know, let's go, let's do this. And when she did examine me, she was like, oh, you know, you're doing great. You're in labor now, so you can go back to the labor ward. And I remember there was just this sense of relief because my body was actually doing the things that it was meant to be doing. So it was just lovely to be able to, you know, I was sitting on a birthing stool for a long time. And it was just so nice to not feel stuck and not feel like I didn't have a choice in what was happening. It was different and it was nice. I hadn't outruled needing an epidural, but I think the very stubborn part of me was, you know, well, let's just keep pushing it out another little bit and another little bit. And eventually I got to a stage where I felt like I couldn't do it. I went through this crazy, like, I can't do this anymore. This is insane. Why am I even having, you know, a baby? And my midwife just said, you know, why don't you just hop on the bed and let me examine and we'll see how far along, you know, things are. I had that little bit of fear of, oh, you know, what if she examines and I haven't changed, you know, nothing's progressed. And she was like, no, I really think you're going to have a baby soon. You know, you're really making all the right sounds and moves here. And that's why I want to examine you. So I was like, okay, she has faith in me. I can have faith in me. So up on the bed, I did climb and lo and behold, she was like, you're 9 centimeters. Like, we're going to have this baby soon. And I think I was in this like shocked state. Just that kind of like, what? Like, I really expected her to be like, you know, you're 5 centimeters, 6 centimeters. You know, I really didn't think she was going to say you're 9 centimeters and you're going to have a baby in the next like little while. I'm kind of just looking at my partner going, oh my God, you know, my body has just done this and I've just achieved this thing and I'm getting emotional about it now. But I was just so proud of the fact that my body could actually do these things. That, you know, something that I had felt that I had failed at, that is so central to humanity, you know? Here I was about to finish that journey. Finish the journey, she says, and you know, it just begins another motherhood. And
yeah, exactly.
But definitely, you know, the whole pregnancy and birth just was summed up in that moment for me of being able to birth a baby naturally, you know, no epidural, no help. I say no help, but obviously, you know, midwives and everything do a fantastic job.
Yeah.
But I was doing this. I was pushing this baby out. And it made such a difference. I think it healed an awful lot of what I had felt. It definitely stopped me feeling that I had failed. you know, I can look back now and see that for my first baby, induction wasn't a necessary process and it had to be followed, and it wasn't that I had failed. I think I could make peace with it in some way because I had had the experience of having the natural birth, because that was so important to me.
Mm.
I just felt that that healed my heart around that whole first experience.
Mm.
And we breastfed.
Yeah.
And like, absolutely, we had to figure out all the breastfeeding things that everybody has to figure out. And
yeah.
There was tongue tie and stuff, but, you know, I fed him until he was almost two.
Mm.
So it was just such a lovely experience.
Mm.
And definitely healed a lot of things that I felt I didn't have control over.
Mm.
In my first pregnancy and birth.
Mm. So you had that healing experience of the second birth. And then a few years ago, you had a traumatic experience that meant that you ended up needing stitches. Do you want to maybe tell me just about going to the clinic and asking for help and the experiences you had around that time?
Yeah, I went to the clinic to be seen and examined, and I was told I needed stitches. And I think I didn't really pay much heed to it. You know, I just kind of got the stitches and you know, picked myself up and moved on with what had happened. But when those stitches had healed, I realized that there was an issue with the way that they had healed.
Yeah.
So I've been left with like this skin flap, for, you know, lack of a better term. Mm. You can't see it. It's not external, but it's internal. It's just inside the vagina. There's like this little bit of skin that is just there.
Mm.
That obviously when I was stitched, what just wasn't stitched properly.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me. It's not you know, it's not overly painful. The way that I was stitched was certainly painful. It made anything like speculum exam, smear test, anything like that, it made it really, really uncomfortable. It almost felt like I had been sewed up too tight, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And I went to be seen about it. You know, I went to my GP first, and the response was, well, sure, look, if it's not bothering you. And I kind of thought, well, no, like it is bothering me. And the fact that I felt my perineum and that was tight, I was told, well, you know, it'll stretch out.
Mm.
Like, what does that mean? Like, I'm certainly not I'm not swinging out of my perineum. I'm not stretching it out. Like, should I be? Is that something I should be doing? I just thought the whole response was very blasé about it.
Mm.
And very much a, sure, what are you complaining about? Like, you know, sure, aren't you stitched back together and on you go. You know, mm. pick yourself up and, you know, clean off the dirt and keep going. And I don't think that it was really understood that this particular skin flap serves as a reminder to me.
Yeah.
It serves as a reminder of this particular event in my life that I would very much rather not have happened.
Mm.
I don't think that was understood. The emotional aspect of it just wasn't understood.
Mm.
It's like, well, it's there and it's not a problem. It's not painful. You know, why are you talking to me about it?
It was referred to as cosmetic, wasn't it, when you asked for it to be dealt with?
Yeah, very much so. You know, they were like, well, you know, that's a cosmetic procedure. So, and I was like, okay, well, like, what would that mean? I was basically told that I would have to go privately to a consultant and pay. You know, there was no option for having that done publicly, or even having the idea of it entertained. It was almost like I had said, hey, I would like to have a nose job. Where do I go? You know,
yeah.
It was kind of a bit of a shock to me to think that you could have somebody who comes into your practice to say, this is the thing that happened. It's truly awful. Here are some things that I've been left with.
Mm.
I really need to get this sorted and fixed because it's killing me. You know, it's a reminder of something that I don't need to be reminded about. And although it's not causing, you know, me physically a lot of pain, emotionally, it's really breaking me down.
Yeah.
I actually went to get a second opinion about it. And it was the same, you know, attitude towards it. I was met with confusion. Like, I don't understand why you're telling me about this because you've just told me that you don't have any issues with it.
Yeah.
The whole emotional side of it just wasn't taken into account. And that just infuriated me. It's still not dealt with. So for anyone listening, yes, I still have a vagina skin flap going on.
Yeah. But
do you know, like, I just don't understand why women aren't taken at face value to say, hey, this thing is going on with my body and I would like something done about it. Can you help me? And to be told, well, no, because I don't understand why you want anything done with it.
It's not a problem to me, so why is it a problem to you?
Yeah.
Now, you're training to be a midwife now.
Yes.
I'm curious about how the experience of training to be a midwife has impacted on how you look at the experiences you've had. Has it changed anything? Has it changed how you feel or how you think about what happened?
Yes and no. So there will... I think there will always be the emotional side of things and, you know, your feelings around your experiences will always kind of be there. But I am able to see them in a different perspective and in a different light. So when I had my second baby, I thought induction was the devil. You know, it was the source of all these problems.
Yeah.
And obviously it's not. You know, obviously it's necessary and there are many different reasons for it. And I can see that, especially, you know, training to be a midwife, I can see the benefits of it and I can see the reasons why it needs to be done and how sometimes, yes, that does lead to a C-section, but it's through no fault of anyone. You know, like, these things just happen. This is how our bodies, you know, react. On the other side of it, I think having those experiences has definitely aided me in being with the woman who's laboring, the person who's laboring, and having that compassion and understanding that I might know what I'm talking about and this might be, you know, my bread and butter on this particular ward, but to that person in the bed, this is a very unique and special moment for them where they are very vulnerable. And sometimes they just need that little extra care, that little extra few minutes to make sure that they fully understand what's happening. Or just that pause, that allowance for silence so that they can ask that question that they need to ask. And I think that's definitely something that stays with me.
I know you're passionate about trauma-informed care as well. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is and what that might look like?
Yeah, I suppose it's just recognising that just because a person physically looks well doesn't always necessarily mean that there isn't something else going on. And trauma-informed care, it just allows you to pick up on the different signs, be they emotional, be they, you know, body language, of what's going on with that person, and then being able to adequately support them in that care. So really making sure that they understand what's going on, making sure that you've got consent, an informed consent, and giving them that breather to prepare themselves for, you know, something that they might find traumatic or that might cause them discomfort or to be triggered into that trauma. And I think it's something that can be forgotten if it's not evident, if it's not really in your face, you know, if somebody isn't vocalizing their discomfort. I think that all these subtle little signs can be missed, and I think that's what's really important to be mindful of and to watch out for.
Mm.
Especially when there's the research out there to say that 1 in 4 women have been assaulted, or there's so much out there. We know that we're meeting these women, but we're not necessarily being mindful of the trauma and the impacts of that.
Yeah. How would you like to see maternity care in Ireland develop in the coming years? Or is there anything you'd like to see change, or anything you'd like to see added?
Oh, that's such a big question.
Sorry. I know.
Oh, yeah. There's so much I would love to see changed and added to. First off, the fact that where you live determines the type of care that you can access.
Mm.
You know, we have 19 maternity units, but not all of them are facilitated to be able to handle more complicated cases. You know, so you have people from the other side of the country coming to hospitals in Dublin for care. It's just cruel and unusual to make somebody who's going through something travel so far and be so far away from their support networks and their families.
Yeah.
Especially at this time, you know. I would love to see birth centres. I would love to see more midwifery-led care. You know, there's so many studies out there to say that, you know, midwifery-led care doesn't lead to as many interventions.
Mm.
It's just a really good option for women. And I think to not have that choice, it just speaks to what our country has done to women, I think, you know, with all the different things that have gone on. It's just another kind of slap in the face almost that hasn't been prioritised. We have the National Maternity Strategy. It was created in 2016. We're now 2021. How far have we gotten with it? Not very.
Mm.
You know, and there's so much in that, like the birth centres and midwifery-led care, that if it was given the money and the resources to be acted upon, we'd be in a much better state of affairs when it comes to maternity services.
That was Melissa Plunkett on Bits of Me. If you like what we're doing here, you can support Bits of Me by sharing it with your friends and social networks, by subscribing, rating and reviewing the podcast, or by signing up to become a patron at patreon.com/bitsofme. Thanks for listening.